Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. I want to appreciate and all of our listeners today for taking time to join us. And also, if you're new to Midrats and if you want to catch up on some of the show you've missed, you can go ahead and head over to the archive at Blog Talk Radio. Or if you would like to, you can take the shortcut and subscribe to the free podcast over on iTunes or Stitcher. Usually during the live show, we encourage everybody to go ahead and head on over to the chat room. There seems to be a little bit of problem with that today, but that's okay. You can always check us out on Twitter, at Commander Salamander. If you have any points of order or questions you'd like for us to direct to our guests, if you can't get the chat room to work, just go ahead and drop me a line over at Twitter, and I'll do the best to incorporate your questions during the course of the show. Let's go ahead and dive into it. For those of us in the southern tiers of the Republic, we're here at the height of hurricane season, and are keeping an eye on the Central Caribbean as Matthew is working up a head of steam. And I think that's kind of a good reference point to use for the start off of our conversation today, because we can think about the last really big hurricane to hit. And though we've had superstorms and bad winter storms, really when people think of disruptions to civil society, they look back at Hurricane Katrina and the security of the local individuals, their property, the economy of the region, and also the political direction of the states that were hit, the region, and even the nation were impacted by events such as Hurricane Katrina that can disrupt civil society and really energize the people focused on what are really the foundations of living from day to day. And as we also saw in the attacks in New York City and in Washington, D.C. back in 2001, terrorists are aware of the effects that huge disruptions of civil society can take place. And with a global economy, if they do it right and they hit the right targets and they get the right secondary effects from an economic and political point of view, even these very localized events, maybe even events that don't have very many deaths, can have a global impact. And that's some of the cornerstones of the discussion we're going to have today, looking at ways to prevent, prepare for, and if you are find yourself on the receiving end of such an event, how to recover from these events, whether they are caused naturally or by direct human intervention. But we're going to look at some of the high-end possibilities, basic terrorist attacks, up to and including what would really be above the fold, something that would involve chemical, biological, or even nuclear weapons. We have a great guest on today to discuss this and other related topics, J. Michael Barrett. He is director for the Center for Homeland Security and Resilience. His previous experience include being the director of strategy for the White House Homeland Security Council, an intelligence officer for the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and a senior analyst for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He's a former Fulbright scholar to Turkey, and Mike has served as a Homeland Security Fellow at the Manhattan Institute, the Olin Foundation, and also a fellow at Johns Hopkins University. Done a little bit of research as well as an analyst for the Center for Strategic International Studies. He got his MA in Strategic Studies and International Economics at the aforementioned Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies in D.C., and he has an MBA from the Australian School of Business in Sydney. He's also a graduate cum laude with a BA in International Relations from the University of Pennsylvania, and he's an occasional guest lecturer at National Security, National Defense University, Georgetown University, and Joint Special Operations University. If you are a consumer of media, you've also read him or may have seen him as a guest on a variety of business-related and news-related shows. Mike, welcome back to Midrats.
Thanks so much for having me. Always a pleasure.
Yes, sir. And since we had you on last, you kind of found a new gig, and a lot of the things you're working on just play right into our topic today. And I just wanted you to give a chance to share with the listeners what you've been working on for the last year, and that is the Center for Homeland Security and Resilience. And it states that it's a new kind of think tank. What makes the Center for Homeland Security and Resilience a new kind of think tank, and what are some of those areas that y'all are focused on?
Sure. Well, thanks for the question. I guess the way that I look at it is there's an important amount of work that needs to be done that's kind of at the high level, academic, long-term research projects. And that is critical work, and it's good that the university system that we have and some of the other think tanks around D.C. tend to do that. And then you have a few that are, you know, that are pretty well aligned with one or two very specific special interests. So if it's nuclear disarmament, or if they're kind of pro-gun lobby or things like that, you have other think tanks that will talk about that. What I realize when I look back over my career, the places where I've had the most impact is when I get a chance to be right in the middle, being a translation function between the lessons that come out of the deep, heavy academic analysis to the guys on the ground that are trying to get the job done. And that's what I think is really missing. We don't have the sense of we can do it and let's get in and kind of get our hands dirty and make real change happen anymore. What we seem to have is a very echo chamber filled with very smart people, sort of, you know, if you will, sitting back in their leather chairs and smoking their pipes and talking in an academic sense about things. And then you have the government people and the private sector people that are just trying to survive day to day. I've been in the government way too many years on my own, and, you know, it's very hard to get things done. You've got a million meetings. Everything's complicated, interagency. So you have to look outside to the think tank community to get the good ideas. But what I find is that we're not really finding practical good ideas that can be implemented. And in a field like Homeland Security that's still relatively new, post 9/11, trying to determine the right balance between counterterrorism versus emergency management, I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done that has to be really focused on reasonable solutions that can be practically implemented. And I think that's what's frankly missing from the debate.
When we talk about the resiliency, and you have certain areas, I guess, that you think we should really be focused on to make sure that these institutions are more resilient than they currently are. And among those would be electricity. And I just we suffer here in North Carolina through the rupture of the Colonial Pipeline, which I'm well familiar with one of my prior jobs, but that kind of infrastructure, that's what we're looking at when you're talking about resiliency and guarding these things for the future.
Yeah, so that's a great point. One of the things that we did in the government, right, we labeled things as critical infrastructure. And unfortunately, when we started doing that, there were grants and other programs and benefits attached to be getting yourself labeled as a critical infrastructure. So everybody wanted to be listed. We now have, you know, depending on who you talk to, 16, 17, 18 sectors that are considered critical infrastructure. At the end of the day, what I think it really comes down to when you're talking about a major disruption, the kind of thing that keeps society moving, you've got to have power. So the electrical power grid, you know, primarily, but also the movement of fossil fuels and things like that to keep the cars moving. You've got to have the transportation systems open, both maritime and airtime, as well as the roads and being able to move people. You've got to have the telecommunications. Those are the three. If you have any two of the three, you can at least, for example, make the phone call to somebody who can then get on the road, you know, and drive away. So if you got to at least have the comms and the transportation, or the electrical power and the comms, you know, you got to have those three things, or it's going to be really bad. When you look back at things like Sandy and Katrina and some of the other major disruptions, it's when those get messed up that you really have a bad time. So I think we tried to do originally in the first few years of Homeland Security after 9/11, we tried to be risk-based, and then we switched to what we called risk-informed. And the problem with something like terrorism is it's very hard to put a mathematical number on the likelihood of a given event in a given day, in a given location. It's essentially impossible. But because I can't do that, but I can predict storms, all the money, therefore, should go to storm remediation. And all the money should go to immigration, because we know that that's a problem every day. And all the money should go to more TSA agents at the airport, because that's a problem every day. And so you end up in this battle where you're paying a lot of attention to the things you can see, but you're maybe not paying attention to the medium and long-term things that you can't see. The pipeline example is a great one. Anything involved in the power grid, the infrastructure, you know, folks don't realize it. It was built out about 100 years ago initially, the power grid, and it has been referred to as, you know, the greatest engineering marvel of the 20th century, which is both amazing to think about what a role electricity has in our lives and then also to realize that was the 20th century, and we haven't done a whole lot of updating since then. I mean, we still have the same basic business model. And so when we think about infrastructure and the power grid and the Internet of Things and the Bluetooth connectivity to your washing machine and, you know, the meters that can be read by a car driving down the road, all of these various pieces are important and interesting, but the infrastructure that's going to enable that hasn't been figured out yet. We know we can do it, but we don't have standards, we don't have protocols, we don't have security built in. One of the things that I've discovered in our research, we've recently put out a couple white papers on this, is we're anticipating at least $2 trillion of expenditure in the next two decades rebuilding the power grid. And that's one of those things where you look at that and you say, that is a lot of money. And if you're going to spend $2 trillion, you could really radically improve the system, or you could change to, you could decide to just kind of keep it the way it is. But there's no way that having been designed 100 years ago, rebuilding what we currently have is the right way to go. So what are some of those conversations that you want to have that would allow you to reconstitute the system quickly if there were a massive disruption? And that's really where resilience comes in. Resilience is about being able to take the punch and then to reconstitute yourself afterwards. And unfortunately, that's not something we spend a lot of time on. Homeland Security as a department, the Department of Homeland Security, gets very much distracted by some very routine activities like immigration and customs and TSA kinds of things. And therefore, they just don't have the bandwidth to think and to be a sort of an active participant focusing on some of these bigger picture issues.
Let's pull the thread on that a little bit because we've had the Department of Homeland Security in its charter for about a decade and a half now. And many times when institutions are created in a moment of crisis, especially very large institutions, everybody should expect some imperfections, perhaps some mistakes in structure or emphasis or even charter. And you refine it as you go along. But that can be difficult when you're talking about big institutions and the big blocks of money that come with it. So here we are a decade and a half with the Department of Homeland Security that in theory is designed to take care of a lot of the issues that you just talked about. Is part of the solution to developing better resilience is to look at the Department of Homeland Security and how some of their distractions are preventing it from focusing on areas that have more importance in the medium and long term, vice the shiny object that's rolled in from an intermediary. And is it time to look again at disaggregating the responsibilities of the Department of Homeland Security that might enable a better focus on some of these areas as opposed to having an entire institution change course in a particular sexy direction of an election cycle?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the right question, and I'm happy to explain my idea. There are certainly other people who have other opinions, and there's some merit to the notion that, you know, we're already started down this path, so maybe we should keep continuing and try to fix the problems as we go. That's kind of been the attitude towards it. And I think there's a political reality that it's very difficult to fiddle with the Department of Homeland Security because you're scared that as you're doing that, something bad happens and you get blamed for it. So having stipulated that there's some real political resistance to the notion that we need to actually take a hard look at the missions and disaggregate them, let me explain to you why I think that actually is the right idea. So first off, and I come in at this as a national security guy, a Department of Defense background, am as guilty as anybody else in the time frame 2001 to say 2005 or 6. We did not understand, we who were national security, overseas focused, looking at the threat of terrorism, how much is done domestically that is Department of Justice grants to state and local law enforcement, as a great example. Well, a lot of that money was rolled up. All the money that used to go to FEMA was rolled up into what we call the Department of Homeland Security. So you have two major cross threads there, right? One is that your function is to support state and local law enforcement, and another one that your job is to support state and locals in emergency management. Now, there's five or six other major cross threads throughout the department, customs and immigration. You've got, you know, airport security and things like that. You've got critical infrastructure protection writ large. You've got the Coast Guard rolled in there, Secret Service rolled in there. I mean, you know, so there's lots of main sort of silos of activity that were basically all just thrown into a blender. And people thought, well, let's, you know, let's push go on the blender and we'll mix it all together and we'll fix it as we go. And the reality is we didn't do that. We did not really break down the stovepipes and the solos, in the silos. So you can still reach into the department and talk to the Coast Guard about Coast Guard-related activities that have absolutely nothing to do with DHS headquarters. And DHS headquarters can have an opinion, and the Coast Guard doesn't care. I mean, that's the reality. Same thing with the Secret Service. Same thing with an awful lot of the programs that are focused on helping state locals. Now, certainly in the last year, 2 years, we've had lots of ongoing issues with state and local police officers and domestic problems with perceived racism and cops and, you know, some other major domestic problems. But the reality is when DHS is engaging with state and local law enforcement and trying to come up with standards for body cams and worrying about some of the civil liberties aspects of state and local law enforcement, they're not. By definition, there's only so many hours in a day. They're not thinking about how to integrate counterterrorism and intelligence activities into local law enforcement. And so when you look at kind of the real activity base of what goes on in DHS, most of it is focused on taking federal money and spreading it out to the state and local community. That's an important role. But unfortunately, because the state and local community is not really ready to do counterterrorism and intelligence, as we in the national security community talk about it, TSS, SCI, Top Secret, Special Compartmented Information, receiving information from the CIA, DIA, and others, they're not really ready and able to absorb that information. And so the preponderance of the Secretary of Homeland Security's time just necessarily has to be spent on the kinds of issues that are dealing with immigration and customs and some other activities that really are not tied to counterterrorism, which was kind of the reason to create the department. So when we created it, we did this. Not only did we pull personnel from the field generally of emergency management and of law enforcement, but we pulled all the money from those two sources. And then that really brings me to the second thing that happened. I refer to Hurricane Katrina often as the storm that washed away counterterrorism. Because, if you take yourself back in your mind back to 2004, we were very focused still 3 years after 9/11 on counterterrorism as the main mission and people trying to figure out how are we going to do this. But then after Katrina, emergency management really popped back up. I was not in the Bush White House at the time, but I came in later. And I can tell you that there was a real sense that not only had they failed, but of disbelief about having been blamed for racial overtones and things like that in the failure. So the administration sort of had two black eyes, right? One black eye was, how did we do so? And then second, how did we not only fail, but we failed in a way that a significant portion of our population thinks we were racist or intentionally choosing to fail them as opposed to just being bureaucratically incompetent. And with the two black eyes, we basically put a whole new focus on Homeland Security as emergency management. And in a way, that was a reverting back to the original purpose of a lot of the funding that came in. And then the same thing happened with some of the money that came in that was originally DOJ money, Department of Justice money, that was going to state and local law enforcement. So we have naturally a focus on federal distribution of money to state and local. And that's good. That's important. But that is inevitably going to be focused on today and tomorrow, what you might call the five-yard target, the five-meter target. You're not looking at how do we look at plausible alternative future scenarios and help private sector fill security gaps between where we want to be, where we are today, where we want to be in 5 years and 10 years and 20 years. I mean, we just don't do that. But if you're thinking about chemical, biological, nuclear weapons, you're thinking about not only what is ISIS, right? ISIS being a terrorist group that tells people to attack in their homeland. But when you start thinking about ISIS people being able to say, attack in your homeland, but take a little while and build a group of other people and find access to radiological material, not just drive your truck into a crowd, right, which we, of course, saw done with great effect in France. But when you start thinking that people could figure out how to build bombs on their own, as we saw recently in New York, the future of terrorism could get much worse. And that high-level catastrophic area, that's really what I think matters, because that's where the society as a whole could be affected. And I think if government has any legitimate role, it starts with things that affect society as a whole. And unfortunately, we just don't have the ability to focus on that right now. So I think at some level, if we expect the Department of Homeland Security to do that, that's unlikely to happen. I think reorienting the entire department is unlikely to happen. So I do think that there's some way to either break off the big picture long-term resilience piece and make that a separate focus area. You know, maybe you give it back to the DOD, or you make it a part of the intelligence community. There's a couple of different ways to do it. But leaving it as part of this organization that has more than 90% of its focus is really on direct support to state and local, it's going to be very hard to get them to be thinking 5, 10, 20 years out and shaping and leading, as opposed to gently suggesting.
Well, you identified some areas of concern. I'm sitting here thinking, well, if we're going to mitigate the damage is done in one of these areas, and since you wrote a couple of white papers on the electrical grid, let's kind of focus on that. I mean, there are so many ways that system can go bad, and you know, from if you're a wacko survivalist, you know, it's the EMP that wipes out the grid completely, and we're all fighting zombies and stuff, or whatever, and all the other little things that can go wrong that can crash the system. As you look at that, I mean, is the onus on, from your point of view, on the companies, the industry, to mitigate potential risks, or is it a business government partnership that's required?
Yeah, I think it ultimately is a business, you know, what we call a public-private partnership, so business and government working together. And naturally, I mean, the government folks tend not to really understand business, and the business folks tend not to really understand government. And that's kind of, again, where I think that the Center for Homeland Security and Resilience can play a key role, being that middleman helping to translate between the two camps. Because there are lots of areas of overlap where the two clearly work together. Unfortunately, the government point of view, let's just talk about it from that perspective for a minute. The government perspective seems to be mostly, I guess, I would like to regulate things, because if I say thou shalt do this, then you have to figure out how to do it and pay for it. So since the critical infrastructure, particularly talking about, again, the power grid, the vast preponderance of it is owned by the private sector. So they're trying to come up with security standards and protocols and things that then the bill is paid for by somebody else, by the private sector. Okay, well, let's flip that around and look at it from the private sector point of view. You want to give me standards and regulations that I have to pay for. Well, then I'm going to choose to be minimally compliant. I have no incentive to do things better than the bare minimum legal requirement to comply, because that's what everyone else is going to do, and I can't overspend on this. With Power Grid, you have an additional fun fact, which is that it's very often controlled. The rates are controlled by the states and the local communities, and everyone's worried about the cost of electricity. Now, currently, the cost of electricity is roughly the same as it was in terms of the amount of money that people spend out of their pocket on it. It's very, very low out of your income, right? So it's, you know, it's marginal percentage. So having a marginal increase in the price is not going to be that devastating to most people and most businesses. There are, of course, you know, they refer to it as a progressive problem, because if it is a larger percentage of your paycheck today, right, even if it's, you know, say a $50 a month electric bill, if you make that $60, there are people for whom that would be a significant hurdle. And so we have to keep the rates low for everybody. Well, that doesn't really make a lot of sense at the end of the day. There's other ways to fix it where you're giving rebates and subsidizing it for the folks who really can't afford it. But you have other folks who are end users of electricity that want a very, very high, pure, moderated, you know, modulated type of electricity that comes in that's very consistent, because they're running high-speed computers and they can't have the fluctuations and variations. You have other people that are just massive users, and they have a need for always having it pure and having it very, very much guaranteed that it's always going to be there. And having a one-size-fits-all system with the variety of end users that we have doesn't really make much sense. But we have no incentive right now for the power industry to service the needs of, say, a server farm that wants a certain type of very strongly controlled flow of electricity. They get paid to sell electricity. And they only get paid a certain rate, and they can only get reimbursed for certain expenditures. So they have no incentive to build out the entire system to be good enough to serve a server farm, because they're going to end up losing money in that situation. They're building essentially, it's not pure is not the right term, but it, just for sort of layman's thinking about it, pure energy that is at a guaranteed modulation of the watts that are coming in and out. So the quality that is needed by certain end users exceeds that which is needed by the general population. But the power company is not incentivized to provide more pure power going into those places. So that's where you get the rise of things like microgrids. And people say, okay, well, how do we build out microgrids? Well, public-private partnerships. We could give out tax rebates. We could think about ways that the local community and the power businesses, the industry, can have a set of rules and standards that they operate under, where you're taking advantage of public lands, or you're getting permission to build and right of way and things like that smoothed out, which is a business benefit, and some rebates, which are business benefits. And on the flip side, you can integrate in green technologies if that's what you want. The other piece, though, the part that I really key in on being a security guy, is some very simple basic things like interchangeable parts. So if you think about in a military analogy, back in the Civil War, we had figured out that if we had interchangeable parts, that meant that all the guns were built to the same standard. And so if the guy next to you got shot, you could grab his bullets and put them in your gun. I mean, it's as simple and basic as that. Interchangeable parts. So having things that are modular and interchangeable gives you a sense of resiliency. It makes it easier to bounce back when something bad happens. But we don't have any of that in the power grid. The power grid is almost entirely one-off systems that were built to go in that specific location, you know, under those size and weight constraints and handling that type of power going into that place. So from the industry perspective, when a piece fails, when one of the transformers fails, they just want to replace it with, you know, a like model from what failed, instead of upgrading to a more modular and more interchangeable model. There are some interesting examples we can talk about that the government has funded, including DHS to their credit, that they have funded of late, trying to figure out how do we do this technically. But I would argue that there's at least as important a piece of that, which is how do we do this in terms of business? How do we incentivize companies to say, I'm not just paying for you to provide electricity, you know, always on electricity today. I'm paying you to make sure, I'm allowing you to operate under this essentially quasi-monopoly, a localized monopoly, to earn your profits on that. But the requirement of that is that you have a higher level of resilience, a built-in ability to reconstitute should something important, you know, something major and disruptive happen.
I want to build on that. Oh, there we go. I had a little problem with my switch. Sorry about that. I want to pull the thread on that some more, because that was exactly the direction I was going to go in, and for my question, because I don't think it's something that we really intellectualize and talk enough about. And I guess from a naval perspective, you know, what you were talking about is when you're building warship is compartmentalization. You design because obviously when you're at sea, if your ship sinks, you're kind of out of luck. And
right.
Same thing with our critical infrastructure. You build it with the whole mindset of this is a ship that's going to get hit sometime, whether it's a mine, a missile, or you hit a rock that you didn't know was there. So if you get damaged, how do you localize that, compartmentalize that damage area so you don't lose the entire ship? Then you can go in and repair. And in a similar concept of our national infrastructure, because when you look at what a governmental trend is, where you want to have a centralized answer nationwide that applies everywhere. And that's also, if you strictly from an accountant point of view, green eye shade, that's also true. For instance, you could build warships with no compartments and it sure would cost a lot less, but look at the additional risk you're taking up with, you know, one little nudge and you lose the whole thing. And it's something I don't think is appreciated very often until it happens to you. But, you know, my bloodline's been in the southeastern U.S. for 400 years since we got kicked out of Scotland. And I never had the concept of what it was like to lose power, because my family comes from, if you drop back to the 1800s, well, you're gonna sweat a lot, you're not going to smell too good, and you're going to get bit by a lot of mosquitoes. But a couple of decades, I lived up in the Northeast, and we had one of those classic Northeastern ice storms where everything was covered with ice and you lose power all over the place. And in many parts of our country, if you drop back to the 1850s, you freeze to death. And you don't have any running water and everything of that manner. And when it comes into to looking at solutions, how is that battle line being drawn between doing what you describe, being able to compartmentalize, where if you have one of those, whether it's a terrorist attack or the more light, that'd be the most dangerous, but the more likely course of action, you did have a big storm, whether it's an ice event or a hurricane, that compromises that fragile grid in the Northeast, but that problem is localized such that that doesn't cascade down to the mid-Atlantic into the South and headed to West. How much is that argument line going between that mindset and the mindset that, no, we're going to have one solution nationwide, fully integrated at the least possible cost, and we'll accept additional risk of cascade failure? How is that argument move?
Sure. So I think, I mean, again, this is why I love doing your show. You guys are asking exactly the right types of questions and looking at it from a good perspective. So let's take the analogy of the ship again. That ship is paid for by the U.S. Navy, and the commander who is on board that ship, he or she, has control over all the departments. Now, if you said that the electric grid was like that ship would have been built by lots of different people, none of whom were coordinated, and each individual compartment could choose to have security and redundancy or not. But if they each had to choose whether or not to have a double hull or the more expensive hatch that's watertight as opposed to one that just looks pretty good and looks like it's a good seal, at the end of the day, there'd be no reason for them not to all choose the lowest denominator, right? We might as well all have the cheap door instead of the reinforced door, because the guy next to me is going to have it anyway. And if he goes down, we're all going down together. So in a way, it's actually a sort of a genius, and I think I'm going to steal it from you guys, sort of a genius analogy for talking about it, because it's easier to conceptualize a ship than it is the power grid itself. But we have a situation now where, as I said, we're going to spend $2 trillion in the next 20 years rebuilding the power grid. And so the question is, what do we want it to look like in the future? Do we want it to look like essentially a canoe, right, where it's a single hull, and if it gets a hole in it, it's going down? Or do we want to have double hull compartments with watertight doors? I would argue that you want to have the latter. We have the ability now, which we didn't have 100 years ago, to build the latter type, the type that actually has security and redundancy built into it, where you can cut off individual sections. You can seal off a compartment if you have to, and then work on restoring life-saving things to that compartment itself. But the rest of the ship is running completely fine. So that's really where the microgrids come in. And we talk about that in two aspects. The first one is just technological. We now have the ability, because of the computerization and the miniaturization of all the microprocessors, we have an ability to put little tiny sensors in lots of places and collect all sorts of data. So technologically, we know that we can build out a power grid where we have real-time, essentially, visibility on what's happening everywhere. As soon as there's a spike somewhere or there's a loss of energy, it seems to be going into the, you know, into the ether, we can look at it and say, well, it hit the last part of the line fine, and then it hits this part of the line and we're not getting a reading. So obviously there's a problem on that mile of wire. Send a truck out there and go look at it. Or we know that it left you know, from one substation and it went to the neighborhood, but then three of the houses are dark. Well, okay, so obviously it's something between the substation and those three houses. So there's an ability to really create true situational awareness across the grid. But here's the problem. There's no incentive for the power companies to build that. If you think about it, what we're essentially doing is we want to increase dramatically, I mean, non-linearly, massive amounts of data coming into the power grid operator. And what we want to do is we want to have them pay somebody, so pay lots of somebodies, to sit there and aggregate all this data and to really understand what's happening real time, so that we can then encourage people to use less energy. But if I'm the power company, I get paid when you use energy. So my incentive structure is not well aligned to the idea that I should spend a bunch more money analyzing data that helps a home run its dishwasher and its washing machines at night so that they're using less expensive energy. That actually is counter to me. I'm going to spend more money setting up this control room that is fully, you know, fully built out like the Starship Enterprise, collecting all the data in the world and looking at it so that I can then sell less energy, right? There's a gap in the business process between what we technologically can do and what we've set up the system to do. give you another quick example. We spend a ton of money in subsidies for people to put photovoltaic solar panels on their roofs, right? And we'll do that just basically if you're a homeowner in the U.S., you can get, you know, straight-up subsidies, okay? Now, that's a feel-good project, and it does help the environment in a very minimal way in terms of creating things from solar power from random rooftops that may or may not be well-positioned. Maybe they're in the northeast or the southwest. Well, if they're in the southwest, they're getting a lot more sun, right? So it's just natural that there's more hours of sun per day. They're going to get, you know, better bang for your buck by putting it in that region. But it's a national rebate that we give to people if they buy them and put them on their houses. And again, their rooftop may be suboptimally aligned for receiving the sun to create the energy. But we give that to individuals. Why can't we give the same types of rebates to industry that would go and buy a piece of land or would do an enhanced use lease, which is what we call when we use government land, including military installations, by the way, take a large facility, a large swath of land that's basically underutilized by the federal government, whether it's, you know, a decommissioned airport or just some test ranges or things that we have in the government or some of the national parks even. You could take this freely publicly available land, again, could be on a military base, could be on an installation, and allow industrial scale solar cells to be set up. Now, they do this a little bit in sort of a test run. They've done this in a few places, but we're not doing it at scale by any stretch. You could do that. You could create the same incentives that you're giving to individual homeowners, but give them to industry. Now, everyone's going to complain that you're giving a subsidy to industry. Well, yes, you're giving a subsidy to industry to meet your environmental objectives and also to offset the fact that now you're going to be getting a lot of that data in, and now they have an incentive to have that control room where all the data flows into and they can manage how much is coming in and how much is going out. So that's what I mean when we say a public-private partnership, something that is really looking at the pure benefits. I mean, you know, we all hate to use the phrase, but it's so perfect, encapsulates it. You want that win-win, right? You want the thing that takes best advantage of the natural resources of the various parties, whether it's the state, local government, a military installation, or the industry itself that has the technical know-how to build this stuff out.
I'm as you were talking, Mike, I'm sitting here thinking of California, which has been pushing power plants out of its own state. And that would seem to me to
enhance brownouts, by the way.
Well, it seems to me it's going to enhance its opportunity to fail. I mean, now we're talking longer distribution lines and the system that they have no control over because they've pushed them all off to Arizona or Nevada or someplace. I mean, is that the kind of problem that our national government needs to step in and say, you know, you can't do that? Or is this where, and I want you to define this what did I write down here? I wrote down micropods, but it's
microgrids. Yeah.
Microgrids, right. Where would they fit into the discussion about what California is trying to do or has done?
Sure, sure. So there's a couple different things, and it's an evolving term because it is sort of a new field. We've talked about them for a while, but in terms of actually building them, it's still relatively new. And we can come back to the business case for that in a minute because I think that's, again, where the military piece of this comes in and where you can create the public-private partnership. But to answer your question specifically, there are places like, let's say, the Google complex where they're going to have a whole ton of computers running, right? That's in California. It's down at the Valley. So there's a certain amount of power that they want, but they want power that is both more assured come what may, so more resilient, and of a better, I used the term earlier, purity. That's not technically the term, but, you know, for the layman, you kind of want certain characteristics of the power that's coming in to be very consistent because you're running high-speed computers, running massive amounts of calculations on this stuff. So you don't want to have any – if you think about, you know, in my house, it's an older house. When I put on the washing machine and the dishwasher at the same time, the lights flicker a little. So you don't want that if you're Google, right, if you're running these server farms and things. So they'll create a very, very, very small microgrid, like a truly microgrid just for their campus. They have their own power plants, and they're not on the grid at all. Often they can connect to the grid if they wanted to, if something happened to their generators, but they are essentially an island unto themselves. And that makes a lot of sense for them, but it's extremely small. So very localized creation and distribution. You don't have long power lines that you're trying to use. For the example that you were using about California as a whole, it actually makes more sense, land being so much cheaper in Arizona and New Mexico and Nevada. it's actually probably makes sense to create a larger, but still micro in the sense that it's not covering, you know, the nation as a whole, microgrid, where you would have very specific generation, which could be some combination of coal and solar and, you know, other types of power plants, and specific power lines that go from there right into a particular community of users. So let's say, you know, Southeast or San Francisco, right? You might have a specific set that goes into San Francisco. And because it is a smaller self-contained system that is kind of an island unto itself most of the time, there's resiliency built in because it can always go back into the bigger ocean, kind of the bigger piece of the grid as a whole, but it can also operate on its own. And what that gives you is an opportunity. I have an analogy that I hesitate to use sometimes because I don't want it to sound as pejorative as it sometimes does, but it's a little bit like public education with the private education system that we have in this country, right? You want to have a guarantee of a certain level of electricity that everybody can have access to. But for certain end users, they're willing to pay more because they want to feel that they're getting more. There are certain characteristics or qualities that they're looking for, and they could pay more for that. So if you are Silicon Valley and you have a certain need for electricity that is, frankly, of a better nature than that which is just the average household consumer, then you should be able to I think from a business perspective, you should make the case that they are willing to pay more money for it if they could get it. But right now they're not able to because there is no way to do it. Well, the purpose of a microgrid would be to create that ability to say, okay, you could have this generation of power that is essentially dedicated to you. Now, in practical terms, like I said, there's issues. If you're going across state lines and things like that, there's issues with right-of-way and taking advantage of currently built infrastructure so you could use power distribution lines that have already been set up, you know, for the grid as a whole. That's where you get into some of the regulatory issues. But those are the kinds of things where that's the future, right? I think ultimately I call it islands and ocean strategy, right? You're going to have islands of energy that is very particular to that community of users, and they can choose the right mix because it does at the end of the day come down to cost. Coal is cheaper, but it pollutes more. So some communities might want to have a heavy preponderance of solar because they feel that it, you know, is more clean and meets their environmental standards, and they're willing to pay more for it. Great. No problem at all. You can pay for that additional type of microgrid if that's what you're into, right? There's no reason not to have the choice to be able to do that. But right now, there's no ability to do that. Right now, it's just, I guess I'll just get my power from the grid because the grid's the only game in town.
One area of the public-private partnership that kind of made me pause a little bit and go, you know, I hadn't really thought of it, but when you look especially at potential economic and national impact, you can definitely see it. That I'd like you to talk about a little bit. You know, y'all have done a lot of work on the power grid. There's focus on ChemBio, Intel-related policing, but one of the other major areas y'all have been looking at is the supply chain, the national supply chain. Why does that belong in the same group of other areas from a homeland security resilience point of view? And how does the public-private partnership tie in to the supply chain challenges?
Sure. So the supply chain stuff, I mean, at the core, it's a little bit of what I was saying earlier, which is the things that you absolutely have to have to survive in the modern era, right? I mean, obviously there's food and water and shelter, but those are, you know, those are very localized, and that's sort of the emergency, the immediate aftermath of an event. The things that you want to have in terms of resiliency are really a combination of transportation and communications and power. And when I look at those, I understand transportation networks, right? I understand how ports work. I understand maritime shipping. I understand how the security procedures that we have at the various ports, how those operate. And that is an area that doesn't get a lot of the kind of hands-on attention that I was talking about earlier. The translation of the deep analytical smart people sitting in a room in an academic environment down to the actual folks that are trying to make things happen on the ground. I think the power grid is very similar to that. Frankly, communications is like that. It's just that it's very complicated, and I don't know much about it. So we don't handle that at the center, more because there is a community of end users that are always pushing the envelope in terms of telecommunications. So trying to help, I guess in a sense, that it's almost like communications has become a very digital world. But in many ways, the business models that we have for the electrical grid and for the global supply chain are still very much analog. And that's because the nature of the industries are still less impacted by things like wireless, right? So the analogy that when you talk about telecommunications is that we used to have this system, right? I don't even have a home phone anymore, right? I'm talking to you guys right now off my cell phone. Lots of folks I know don't even have a home phone anymore. But it used to be that was the only way you could have cell phone service. Well, in the same way, that's the only way that you can have access to the power grid is through a power line, essentially. I mean, you know, you could have your own generators and live off the grid, but basically, in broad terms, everybody still has to have a line that comes right into their house provided by the big company. And so this move to a new model, a new business model, you see that happening in the power industry. Or you can see where that should happen in the power industry akin to how it happened in telecommunications. Now, with ports, it's a little bit different because there's still always going to be a physical location where you have to come in. I mean, everyone's going to have to – massive amounts of maritime cargo are still going to come in through the major seaports. I mean, that's just how it is. We are looking at some ability to screen things overseas. There's some efforts that DHS is putting in to say, in order to relieve some of the congestion that we have at our major U.S. ports, can we screen overseas, know that it's secure when it leaves, say, Hong Kong? We've already inspected it there. And then we monitor it in, you know, as it's traveling and in transit. So if it left on the day it was supposed to and it didn't make any detours and it arrived without any obvious indications of security breach, we can therefore assume that it's secure. So it's a little bit different in the transportation supply world because you still have major physical nodes that you have to go through.
One of the things I noticed is you make a distinction in some of your work between cyber issues and terrorism. And is it the difference between the physical act and electronic act, or why do you separate those two?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've been getting into cyber a lot more because as you dig into it, it does seem initially like cyber kind of happens in this vacuum. It's separate from physical. The new term of art that we use in Homeland Security talks about physical cyber activities. So it's the idea that you're going to have most planned events, you know, terrorist attack type things, could well involve both. So you could have somebody attacking, for example, the power grid, taking down the natural response resources, and then also having a kinetic physical attack. So we're kind of in this space now where we're realizing that cyber is like a pathway. It's how you attack something. But at the end of the day, for the most part, cyber attacks are still going to have some kinetic attack, whether that's destroying the servers where financial data is kept corrupting those servers. Or if you're using kind of like the Stuxnet model where you're using the internet and cyber attacks to take out physical things that are part of a critical infrastructure network, in that case, nuclear research plants. So there is actually a recognition now that we used to treat cyber as separate and that it's actually being much more integrated now into cyber and physical effects combined. That's kind of the thinking that people are using. And I think that's true. But it comes back to, again, we were talking earlier about microgrids, right? One of the beautiful things about a microgrid is I can control how big it is, and I can set standards for it. So I use the example of Silicon Valley. Let's say that Silicon Valley wants to have their own microgrid, right? They can build the most secure multi-layered cybersecurity around that because they can say, in order to feed off of this grid, if you want to be a Silicon Valley company that uses this grid, this is the ante. It's going to cost X amount more than other ways that we could be getting it, but we have built in additional multiple layered security. That's ultimately the power of the microgrid, is that the community can choose what they want to have. If they want to have sort of an organic, all-natural, completely open environment, and they don't want any security protocols because that's what they believe, that's okay too. You can have that power grid as long as it's segmented away from the main grid. And if you choose to have lower levels of security, but that doesn't impact the rest of the nation, then, you know, I'm essentially libertarian in that perspective. That's okay. You know, people can choose that. But for other people who want to have more security, they can build in really high-end, robust cybersecurity. I think ultimately right now, and this is really a frustrating aspect of the lack of public-private partnership when it comes to the power grid. The federal government's trying to figure out what are the right types of standards to have. They spent a bunch of money at NIST, the national, the group that puts together standards for the country. And they got super smart people putting together very good ideas about how to do cybersecurity, but they're ultimately issuing guidelines and recommendations that are pretty high level and fairly generic, and it becomes a checklist that then has to be implemented by people down the road. Well, it takes a long time to implement, and it's fairly generic, and compliance is sort of more of a checklist approach than a full security engaged process. And so you end up creating vulnerabilities when you go at it that way. But that's what we do. We're taking sort of a heavy-handed, top-down approach, but then we don't actually say everyone must update their antivirus software every week, right? Just to pick an example. We don't have things like that are built into it. We say things like use good antivirus software, and update it regularly. So everything ends up kind of watered down. And on the one hand, I loathe the idea of having heavy-handed, centralized, dictated, top-down regulations that tell people how to do things, because then the environment changes and the government's too slow to update it. On the other hand, we're all at risk because we're all in this together, and if cyber attacks take down the grid, they're going to come at it from the weakest possible link. One of the great examples of this is Target, right? You think about Target retail store. They got attacked. All the credit cards were hacked and stolen. And that was done because somebody hacked into the HVAC system, the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system. Now, who would think when you're setting up an HVAC company that you have to meet the same standards for cybersecurity as the retailer Target who's handling, personal information and credit cards? But at the end of the day, even though you're just an air conditioning company, you have to be at that same standard or else you become the weak link, which becomes the point of entry for that attack. So as we build out the grid, I would love to see a profusion of these microgrids where we could try different security solutions, including physical but primarily cyber, where we could then figure out what the right balance is and then expand it across the broader network as a whole. Instead, what we're doing is we're just basically rebuilding the existing system that we have without giving that laboratory of ideas and allowing different microgrids to get out there and figure out in a closed loop how do we create the security that we need.
A lot of times when you're trying to find better ways of doing what we do as a nation, it's helpful kind of to take a deep breath and look outside our own borders for other nations. For instance, if somebody asked me, hey, how could we benchmark better public transportation? I say, hey, go to the Netherlands and live there for a while and see how they do it. If people want to know how do you properly drive on a road, I say, go to Germany. Learn how to drive on the road in Germany. And so you have some nations that do certain things and a larger civil society point of view that works really well. And when you look at building the public infrastructure that has some of the resilience that we've talked about so far this hour, are there some nations out there that in whole or in part you think are have a good, solid approach that would be worth looking at? Or is this really terra incognita trying to build something that is the best?
So it's an excellent question, and I'm going to be upfront about my ignorance. I don't know. I agree with you, by the way. Germans know how to drive. I don't know of anybody who's doing it the ways that we've been talking about that's really looking at figuring out how to build it in. But I will use an analogy. We were just talking about cybersecurity aspects. There, I think you can actually look at the military, right? It's a community that many of your listeners will be familiar with. We have what we call, the open internet. We call it the NIPRNet in the military. And then you have JWICS, which is the sort of high side, the top secret network. And it's its own completely separate system, right? But there's also the CIPRNet, and that's kind of the interesting one. That's the one that's in between. CIPRNet for secret level information, and it has, some modems that have encryption and things built into it. But it actually, the information on it carries along the exact same lines as the open regular internet. And I think that's an interesting analogy when you think about how can you build some of these types of security measures that we're talking about. How do you add increased layers of security but not have the stunningly expensive aspect of completely separate dedicated lines for everything? So if you were to connect all the sensors in the future from every substation to the power plants to, to your home washing machine, if you were to try to have a completely self-contained network that did that, it would be stunningly expensive, right? You'd have a completely redundant network that is very, very expensive. You could make it, in theory, extremely secure because the only type of information would be one type that's traveling on it, and you could monitor it and make sure that no malicious activity is going on. but it would be stunningly expensive. So the question is, how do you build the analogy of the zipper net, which is that secret level information that can still travel on the same pipes as the regular open internet? So I think the military, in a sense, actually is the right analogy for how to do that. The other piece, and I'll just put in this plug here, as I know we're winding down on time, the military installations that are out there, they're looking at this because they have a national security mission set which says thou shalt not fail in terms of having the power that they need, whether it's to run the airports, you can put the troops on the plane and get them over to the scene of the conflict, or it's the shipping that has to go on in terms of getting the material where it's got to go, or it's the warships that need to be fueled up and manned up and sent out to sea. So we have critical national security priorities that we have to be able to fulfill. So you take a place like Norfolk, Virginia, where you've got the aircraft carrier station. There are certain needs for electricity that you could argue require them to have something higher in terms of reliability and resilience than that which the power grid provides. Because of that imperative, the DoD makes an excellent testbed for some of the kinds of ideas that are out there. And building out some of these microgrids and figuring out how is it that we create that intelligent networked microgrid that has the right level of cybersecurity and risk mitigation and resiliency in case something goes down, the interchangeable parts we talked about, that kind of stuff. You could build out a purpose-built electrical system for something as small as, I mean, it's large in a lot of ways, but as relatively small as Norfolk, that would give both additional energy, surety and security to the local community, but more importantly, from a national security perspective, provide the guarantee that we can sortie the fleet as needed. Now, that's the kind of thing where I think forward-leaning political leadership, if we could find some in this country, would actually be really useful in making the case about. And yeah, it's going to cost a little more to be the first couple people out of the chute, but the military's often been the leader in creating the markets, creating the realities. You think about computing, right? The military was a massive market for computers in the early days. And then, of course, you know, the industry took off once it kind of the ball got rolling. But the military is a great initial marketplace for things like microgrids and bespoke power solutions where you can build in the security that you need and the absolute risk mitigation as well as resilience.
Well, you talked a little bit about the microgrids and their ability to opt in or out of the of a larger grid. Kind of address that a little bit, because you know I could see with the right attitude in certain microgrids, you know, I've got mine, Jack. You're on your own for the rest of it. Is that a danger that if this would could be caused by completely microgridding our system?
Well, I mean, you know, there's some risk of that, right? I mean, at some level, you think about, again, just to use the military base as an analogy, we have the ability to make sure that a military base is a physically secure location, and we put a lot of armed guards around it, nobody gets in. And, you know, we can do that. But, again, as you talk about the broader sense of building out the power grid and using microgrids to supplement and to create pockets of power, you could... You would basically have to regulate it in. So you would say, okay, in order to be a part of this, to get the benefits of being the tax breaks that we talked about in terms of putting in, you know, your alternative energies and things like that, you have to agree to allow the main grid to pull off of your microgrid if, you know, so let's take this, the Hurricane Sandy example. So we lose a certain percentage of power out of the New York, New Jersey area, and we've built in the pipelines to be able to provide it, but we would need to run Norfolk, say, a microgrid at Norfolk at twice its normal capacity. It's still within its limits, but, at, you know, you'd have to run it 24 hours instead of 12 hours. Okay, you can build that in. That you make that part of the cost case, right? So you do cost sharing. We have another thing, and it's an emergency management principle, but it's used widely by fire suppression teams. So when you have a wildfire in California, you often, if you listen to the news, you'll find out that it was a group from Colorado that actually flew out there to help. It's called mutual assistance. So we legislate that in. We build it into the model as you set it up, the mutual assistance. So that if you're in an area that's either very minimally or not at all affected, and you have, therefore have excess supplies, whether it's people or electricity in this case, you have an ability and an obligation to provide that to the area that's in need.
Well, on that mark, Mike, we have a very fast hour coming to a conclusion. Once again, thanks a lot for taking some time this afternoon to join us. And for our listeners, if they wanted to keep a finger on the projects you're working on or what would like to know what you're working on, they could look for in the future, what could they look for next for Mike Barrett?
Sure. Well, I'm doing in conjunction with the Lexington Institute, I'm doing a series on the power grid. So we're going to keep looking at that issue. We really do believe that there is a national security imperative to figure out the microgrids as a key part of the solution. So we're building that out. They could certainly keep an eye on our website. It's www.security-resilience.org. Would love to have the community here, and I'd love to keep the conversation going, because I do think that there is a significant national security component to this. And unfortunately, Homeland Security and national security have in many ways been split apart in the 15 years since 9/11. When you start thinking about some of the chemical, biological, nuclear threats and some of the large-scale impacts like the power grid that we've been talking about, transportation networks, things like that, we are as unprepared today for a massive disruption as we were as unprepared for 9/11 when it happened. And I think that's kind of a sad indictment 15 years on.
Couldn't agree more. And thank you very much, Mike, again, for coming and joining us. And I look forward to talking to you again.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Mike. Really enjoyed it.
And thank you very much for all of our listeners. And until we see you again on the next episode of MidRat, hope you have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
It's a long way to Tipperary.